Welcome to the I Have ADHD podcast, where it's all about education, encouragement, and coaching for adults with ADHD. I'm your host, Kristen Carter, and I have ADHD. Let's chat about the frustrations, humor, and challenges of adulting, relationships, working, and achieving with this neurodevelopmental disorder. I'll help you understand your unique brain, unlock your potential, and move from point A to point B. Hey, what's up? This is Kristen Carter, and you're listening to the I Have ADHD podcast. I am medicated, I am caffeinated, I am regulated, and I am ready to roll. I'm so happy to be here with you today. How are you? How are you? Welcome. Thank you for pressing play on this podcast. I just found out that there are now 5 million podcasts in the world, which I am shocked by. And so the fact that you press play on this little podcast right here makes my heart so happy. So glad you are here with me today. We've got a great show for you today. One of my clients from my focused ADHD coaching program, CJ, is here to talk about her ADHD journey as someone who is undiagnosed for 50 years. And we're going to have a long conversation about generational trauma, ADHD going diagnosed in generations from one generation to the next, and how that impacts us. You're going to love this episode. If you are someone with ADHD, especially if you've gone undiagnosed, I hope you feel seen. I hope you feel validated, and I hope you are so encouraged. So please join me in welcoming my client, CJ. Hi, CJ. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for inviting me. I'm very excited.
Same. I'm so grateful to you Focus members, VIPs, who have agreed to have conversations with me, because sharing ADHD stories is just so important. Being able to hear someone talk about ADHD and see yourself in their journey is so encouraging and so validating. So why don't you share with us just a little bit about your ADHD story? How did you come to a diagnosis? What was that like for you?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I was diagnosed pretty late at age 51, several years ago. And I am a double doser. I have 2 parents with ADHD. My dad was actually officially diagnosed in the 1990s, part of the first wave of adults, mostly men back then, to get diagnosed. And my mom never did. But once I started learning about it, I could see she had all the classic symptoms of inattentive type. And my dad was more classic ADHD, hyperactive little boy, type. So anyway, I had no idea that I had it. It just wasn't something that ever crossed my mind. And so I kind of got diagnosed by accident. And what's interesting is that for people like me who went undiagnosed for a long time, we are good case studies for how symptoms change and, ebb and flow and that sort of thing. So when I was young, as a kid, teenager, into probably up to my 30s, I was really impulsive, a lot of risk-taking behavior, a lot of unsafe behavior, not really aware of, especially as a kid, not really aware of my actions, real lack of self-awareness, not understanding why, people reacted to me the way that they did, not seeing my actions or, really understanding I had no control over things and I didn't understand why, and I didn't see it. I was very unself-aware. So as I got older, a lot of that resolved, or, at least got somewhat better. I mean, it took a long time. I was still like the kid that will eat the cookie immediately and not wait to have 2 cookies when I was in my 30s.
It took me that long.
To kind of figure out that there were patterns going on and, I was repeating the same things and learn from them and try and take time to, you know, make decisions rather than jumping into things, all of that. But I noticed how other symptoms, like, for example, my emotional dysregulation, which like plagued me my whole life, I noticed would worsen with hormonal changes, right? So I'm thinking that it was really like out of control, and that was one of the reasons why I ended up getting a diagnosis. But, you know, perimenopause probably had something to do with that. So even whilst other symptoms got better, some got worse. So that was getting worse. And then I was also really struggling with work because I couldn't focus on, I would be writing a story. You know, I'm a journalist. I'd be writing a story. I was covering environmental issues, and some of it was quite complicated. And I was trying to structure, you know, these complicated stories, and it was getting really difficult. Like, I couldn't figure out the structure. It took me a long time. And so I just felt like there was something wrong with my head. Wrong. Let's put that in air quotes. There's something not working for me, you know, in my head. And so I went to see a neuropsychologist. And this was actually the second time I'd gone to see a neuropsychologist. I'd gone like maybe 10 years earlier for similar reasons, just like forgetting things and other executive functioning type problems and memory. And so I go to this guy and he gives me this very basic test that they give for dementia and those sorts of things. And so I ace that, right? Because I'm like 40. And so, yeah, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, go on your way. What's wrong with you? You're overreacting, you know? And so the second time I went when I was 51, I got a good one. And I explained what was going on. And he just immediately was like, sounds like you have ADHD. And I still, even after knowing that my dad had it and everything, I still was like, what? Really? Me? You know, I still really associated it with hyperactivity, which is like the very obvious, observable hyperactivity common in little boys, is just about the only symptom I never had, right? Wow. Like, it's just about, I do have the restlessness and fidgety stuff, but that's just about the only thing that I didn't have. And I so associated it with that, that it just never occurred to me that that's what problem was. I just didn't understand how it worked. So anyway, that guy says you should see a specialist, get a diagnosis. So I did, got an official diagnosis, and immediately started taking medication. No qualms about that. I know a lot of people don't want to take it, and I totally understand and respect that decision. But I was like, you're going to give me a pill and it's going to fix me? Sign me up.
How did that work out for you? Did you feel like the medication was helpful? Like, what was that like?
It was and is. I actually take two. Nice. Because, you know, I thought it was a pretty severe case going on. And it has been very helpful. But it didn't fix me.
Of course.
You know, I was kind of disappointed. After a while, I'm like, okay, I think there's more work to do here. And what's interesting is that I had been in therapy, you know, before, like long before my diagnosis, because I always knew I had emotional, you know, stuff to deal with. And I'm a big fan of therapy. My parents actually met in group therapy in the 1960s. Yeah, they were.
Wow, they were really ahead of their time in the 60s.
They were pretty progressive and interesting people. So yeah, thanks therapy for my existence. So I'd done a lot of work on emotional stuff, you know, but I could still see that there was things I needed to deal with. And there's the regret, you know, like, oh my God, what could I have done if I figured this out earlier, if I'd gotten help earlier, you know, how much better my life could have been. So I did go back to therapy again after my diagnosis. And I'm not in therapy now, but I think I'm probably going to go back at some point soon. because the book I'm writing gets into some pretty heavy stuff. So I think I'm probably going to need it.
Did I know you were writing a book?
I am.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. Is it a memoir? Is it about you?
It's a reported memoir, and it's based on the life of my maternal grandmother who was mentally ill. Wow. And so, yeah, I'll tell you more about that.
Yeah, this is really beautiful foreshadowing for some of the conversations that we're going to have, because one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on was your interest in generational trauma and your own family's generational trauma and how that may have impacted you and your symptoms. And, you know, the big question is always, is it complex PTSD? Is it ADHD? Of course, we don't know. But like, those questions to wrestle with are just so fascinating. Yeah. So I cannot wait to chat about that. Let's go back, though, to processing your diagnosis and feeling regret about what could have been. Because I think for people who are diagnosed as adults, whether you're diagnosed at 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, there's still that like, man, I wish I was diagnosed when I was 7. Yeah. So that, you know, I could have been treated this whole time. I could have had understanding. I could have had support. What was that like for you to process that regret?
It was hard. I'm not sure I completely processed it. I mean, you know, I'm getting there. And accepting things better than I used to. I'm not beating myself up anymore. It is really difficult because I had a lot of potential that I didn't live up to, right? Like, there were things that I could have done that I didn't do for whatever reason, you know, often because I gave up. Because it got hard, it was too hard, you know. And so, and, you know, watching people younger than me, you know, do things that I want to do, that's always been tough. It's a process. And I mean, I'm really at this point just trying to focus on now, you know, and what is still possible. Because there are a lot of things that aren't still possible. That's just the reality. Like, I'm not going to skydive, right? I missed that window. I'm too scared now. You know, I'm too in touch with my mortality, right? So I'm not going to do that. Yeah. I might have done it when I was 20, but I'm not going to do it now. I mean, there are things that aren't going to happen. I'm not going to go back to college and change careers. You know, it doesn't make sense to put the time in to do something like that. But I can still do things that I want to do. And I'm motivated and, you know, and medicated and regulated and all those things. So I'm
motivated, medicated, regulated. I love that.
I feel like I can, and I have good motivation too. So if I book, for example, I really want to tell my grandmother's story. I feel obligated, not in a bad way, but in a good way, like I'm the only person who can do this. I'm the only person who can tell her story and, you know, allow people to see her and others like her, you know. And that motivation is better than, oh, I just really need to make something of myself, because if I don't succeed, I'm not a worthwhile person. It was often motivated by desperation. You know, desperation to feel like I was a worthwhile person, you know, and we have such a culture of success and productivity and all of those things and work. And we just, I think in the States, and I know, you know, every culture is different, but I'm sure, you know, people in other countries can relate to this as well. Who are we if we're not good at our work? Like, who are we if we're not successful at our jobs? You know, like, it's the first thing that we say. You know, when I first went over to Europe, I was like, amazed when you ask people, you know, so, you know, what's your name? And tell me about yourself. And they'll say, I'm Italian. Or they'll say, I'm English, right? Like, that's the first thing they say. Mm-hmm. And Americans mm-hmm. will say, I'm a doctor. Yep. Like we define ourselves by mm-hmm. our careers, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. What I hear you saying is that there's still pain as you think about what could have been, and there's acceptance and motivation at the same time. So it's like you're feeling more than one thing, which I think is important to highlight, because we often think that we have to choose one way to feel about something, or if we're feeling pain, then there's nothing good to come out of it. But to be able to say, I feel regret and pain still when I look at people doing things and I'm like, man, I wish I would have done that. And also, I'm feeling accepting of where I am and motivated to do the things that I feel called to do.
Right.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's always complicated. It's never going to be, you know, one thing or another. Mm. And it's always kind of a process, I think.
Yeah.
Progress is a process. So, like, you're not even going to feel the same every day. Like, some days I feel pretty good, you know? I mean, I've got a pretty good life, right? I've got a great family. I've got a wonderful husband and an amazing daughter, you know? And I've, you know, had a lot of fun in my life. I've done a lot of things, you know? So it's not like I have a horrible life, right? Yeah. And some days, you know, that's enough. And I recognize that. And then mm-hmm. other days, it'll creep back in, like, you know, and what have you done with your life?
You know, man, that voice. Yeah.
That little voice. That little voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Really not a nice little voice.
No.
When you said earlier that you're like, you went right on medication, you noticed a big difference, you were so grateful for it, but it didn't fix you. What did you mean by that? What does that mean when you say, like, okay, like, medication's great, but there's still work to be done? What does that mean to you?
So beyond the emotional stuff, the medication really helps with the focusing and the regulation and all of that. But I still had a lot of, like, things to unlearn. And I'm still honestly struggling with that. So, for example, I'm super time blind, it's ridiculously time blind. And it drives my husband crazy, because I'll be sitting at the computer writing and I'll say, give me 5 minutes. And he'll come back and he'll be like, it's been an hour. And I'll say, no, it hasn't. It's only been a few minutes. Right. So trying to kind of make my brain do what I want it to do. So I guess it's kind of poetic, but my brain does not like authority, and even mine. Right. So it won't do what I want sometimes. So I struggle a lot with organizing schedules and time management and that sort of thing. And I'm trying all these different things. So, like, I set alarms and, you know, I color code my calendar with pretty little boxes and all of that. And that stuff helps keep me on track if I'm accountable to someone. So if it's a meeting, you know, or an appointment or something, then it helps. But if it's just me saying, okay, time to stop doing that activity because we need to do this other thing over here, you know, my brain will just be like, huh, that's cute, and just do whatever the hell it wants, you know? And I'm like, no, it's like, it's blue color time. Yeah. It's the blue square, right? Yeah. We have to be doing this. And my brain's like, no, I'd rather do this.
Yeah. I relate to that so hardcore. I think that for many ADHDers, and actually there's research to back this up, we often have oppositional defiant disorder, or like at least a little bit of that oppositional behavior. And I so resonate with, like, I'm oppositional to me. to myself. Like, I don't want to listen to me. I don't want to listen to the rules that I set. I resent the rules, or, you know, the calendar that I created for mm-hmm. me. Yeah. Right. It's wild.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Amazing. So what do you feel like has been, you mentioned medication, you mentioned therapy. I know you're in focused. Are there other ways that you're implementing support for yourself with your ADHD? Or what are you finding to be like really helpful?
I've been working on trying to just accept my limitations and, you know, accept what I need, be honest about what I need, communicate that with my family. And that kind of thing helps a lot. I mean, they've been pretty supportive. It's gotten, you know, better over the years. Now we're to the point where they can like joke with me about it, you know, oh, don't talk to mom before coffee, you know, kind of thing. But I mean, that's one of the things, like, I don't even try and do mornings anymore. Like, I don't even try. I need time to wake up, to chill and all of that. My husband brings me coffee every morning.
Oh my gosh.
He's super sweet.
That's awesome.
Most of the time. He can also be a pain in the ass, but most of the time he's sweet.
I mean, I get it. Yeah, that's amazing.
And I really can't have a lot of interruptions. Once I sit down to write, you know, to work, I can't have people, you know, interrupting constantly because it takes me so long to get back into it. And they're pretty good about that. I mean, they still interrupt sometimes, but, you know, they're pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been a part of the process and just understanding what I need to get through the day and accepting and communicating that. It helps a lot.
So what you're talking about is something that I think ADHDers struggle with across the board. And I could be wrong. I'm making a very generalized statement right now. But first of all, identifying what you need. You mentioned at the beginning that self-awareness was something that you struggled with so much throughout your life. And obviously, that is one of our executive functions, the ability to self-reflect. And the fact that we can't even identify needs that we have really can hold us back, because there may be people in our lives who want to offer support and we don't even know what we need. We don't even know what to ask for. And then additionally, many of us, most of us, I dare say, have been conditioned to not express our needs because we've been maybe shamed for what we need, or, you know, been made to feel like we're the problem, or been compared to other people who don't need as much as we do. So I think what you are identifying as some of the things that are the most supportive to you are things that, like, we can all really strive for, is like, first, understand your needs. Second, be willing to express them. Third, be willing to actually receive the support that is offered. Because that can be hard too. Like, if I say to Greg, hey, can you like help me to transition here? Well, the reason why I need help is because I don't want to transition. I'm on the couch. I don't want to transition out. And so to ask somebody for help and then receive the support and not resent the support, I think is really, really important too.
That just reminded me of something when I very first found the podcast. So I found the podcast first, and it was pretty early on. When did you start the podcast?
At the very end of 2018. So like early 2019 is when it really got rolling.
Okay. So I think it was 2020 when I discovered it, and I like immediately was binging all the episodes. And you had one with Greg, and and I made my husband listen to it.
Oh my gosh.
I was like, listen to this. Because sometimes you just need someone else to say it too, you know? And I mean, totally. You're still in not the greatest place. I was still like, you know, trying to get him to understand things. And sometimes mm-hmm. our our neuroses would collide, you know, like he gets anxious about getting things done immediately and I procrastinate. And yet I want to control things. So he would get frustrated and just put the dishes in the dishwasher because he needs the dishes in the dishwasher now. And I would come along when I felt like it and rearrange them because he didn't do it the way I wanted.
Oh my God.
Right. Which would drive him crazy. So I could go on for days about our conflicting neuroses. Sometimes it works for us and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I really appreciated that validation, you know, that the podcast first and then Focus was giving me, because it's just so amazing to have people get you, you know, to hear someone else say what you need to hear when you feel like no one understands and no one gets it. So not only did I, you know, make him listen to it, but it just gave me so much validation. Like the thing that stands out most is just hearing it's hard.
Yeah. You
know? Like I think human beings in general, we just have trouble understanding that something is hard when it's easy for someone else, when it's easy for us.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been guilty of this as well. And I really try and watch it now because, you know, it's so easy to say, really? What? That's so easy. Just, you know, just do it. You know, why don't you just do it?
Yeah. Just because it's easy for me doesn't mean it's easy for everyone.
Right. Right. So just hearing it's hard and, you know, that's normal for someone with ADHD was just so helpful and so validating, and just being part of a community that I can go to Slack with a question or a problem and people get it, you know, and I don't hear, why don't you just, right?
Can you imagine if someone in the Focus Slack said that? They would be, it would not go well for them. No one would ever think to say that though.
No, because they get it. It's an amazing thing when to be seen and understood. You know, everyone wants it, right? All human beings just want to be seen and understood. And so when you have that, it makes a huge difference.
Mm. And now a word from our sponsor. Hey, Kristen here. I'm the host of this podcast, an ADHD expert and a certified life coach who's helped hundreds of adults with ADHD understand their unique brains and make real changes in their lives. If you're not sure what a life coach is, let me tell you. A life coach is someone who helps you achieve your goals, like a personal trainer for your life. A life coach is a guide who holds your hand along the way as you take baby step after baby step to accomplish the things that you want to accomplish. A good life coach is a trained expert who knows how to look at situations, all situations, with non-judgmental neutrality and offer you solutions that you've probably never even considered before. If you're being treated for your ADHD, and maybe even you've done some work in therapy, and you want to add to your scaffolding of support, you've got to join my group coaching program, Focused. Focused is where functional adults with ADHD surround each other with encouragement and support. And I lead the way with innovative and creative solutions to help you fully accept yourself, understand your ADHD, and create the life that you've always wanted to create, even with ADHD. Go to ihaveadhd.com/focused to join. And I hope to see you in our community today. Let's talk a little bit about your family experience. Can you share with us as much as you're comfortable? I'm curious about where you see generational trauma in your family history. And then
after you've kind of talked about that a little bit, I'd like to just chat about like how you see that playing out in your symptoms or whether or not you do. So tell us about your family. I know you have two parents who one diagnosed with ADHD, one you suspect. Do you also know that about your grandparents?
Actually, I suspect that my family is riddled with it, to be honest. But I also suspect that my paternal grandmother, my dad's mother, and he as well said that he thought that she had it. Mm-hmm. My mom's side of the family is a little more complicated because my grandmother on that side was mentally ill. And so when she was 27 and she had three kids, she just had her third child, about 6 months old. She started, well, right after she had her third child, she had postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. And then later on, like a year or so, and they were living down in South America. My grandfather and my great grandfather both worked in mining. So they lived down in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And so then she started to have other symptoms and they eventually brought her back. They all came back to the, or my grandmother, grandfather, and the kids, the three kids came back to the U.S. And she ended up and committed to a number of different mental institutions, but she was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which I'm not sure it was. It may have been a postpartum psychosis. She may have been postpartum bipolar, because that does happen, and mania can produce psychosis and all of that. But she didn't get the help she needed and ended up basically committed for the rest of her adult life. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a sad
That's story. So sad. I'm so sorry.
So I never really knew her. I met her once. I was around 11 years old, my mom, and she was out of the state hospital and in a nursing home. My mom took me to visit her. But my mom was only 9 years old when this happened. And of course, this is at a time when like people didn't talk to kids. People didn't share things with kids. So no one really explained what was going on.
Yeah.
So she was obviously very traumatized. And, you know, mom just disappears and she didn't understand why, you know. And then there were other things as well, like she lost her younger sister in a car accident when the younger sister was only 18 years old. Wow. She died in a car accident. So a lot of trauma and obviously a lot of anxiety around losing people and all of those types of feelings. So it really impacted the way that she parented me. She was very anxious and very overprotective and trying to control things because she had so little control when she was a kid. So like I mentioned before, my parents were pretty progressive and all of that. So they both knew that they had, you know, emotional issues to deal with. And they had gone to therapy and, you know, they talked about, you know, expressing feelings, you know, and allowed me to like express feelings. However, I don't think they went to enough therapy because I don't think that they really healed and internalized, you know, healing. So they still, even though they talked about things, they didn't really perceive what I needed, you know. And I'm not sure if it was because it was painful to think about your kid being in pain or because they just had their own stuff going on. But I was, to an extent, emotionally neglected.
Yeah.
Right? Not in a terrible way, not in an intentional way, not in a, you know, uncaring way, but just in a, they were emotionally immature. Right.
Yeah.
So my dad didn't have such a, you know, definable thing happen in his life. But he did grow up with a father who was, you know, not very nice to him, didn't feel loved by his father. My grandfather was nice to me, you know, by the time the grandkids come around, they get nice, right? Mm-hmm. but he was, you know, like verbally abusive. I don't think he was ever physically abusive as far as I know, but verbally mm-hmm. abusive. And to my grandmother as well, you know, mm-hmm. like all are stupid and stuff like that. You know, that generation was not very in tune with their emotions and mm-hmm. the impact that they had on other people. Mm-hmm. So my dad, you know, has ADHD. So he grows up thinking he's dumb. Pretty much he had trouble learning to read, had needed my mom's help to get through college, all of those things. And he was also a closeted bisexual at a time when they thought that any form of homosexuality or anything that was not, you know, cis, straight, whatever, yeah. was a mental illness. Yeah. And so, you know, he didn't feel accepted by mm-hmm. the overall society or mm-hmm. his, you know, or his own father. And so, yeah, he was depressed and moody and very impatient and easy to anger. Yeah. You know, so I always felt like, as a little kid, I felt scared to bother him. You know, he was a painter, right? So he was an artist. He was an art teacher for a living. And he would go into his art room, into his studio space, and close the door. And I remember, like, wanting to ask him something and being afraid to knock on the door. Like, I was, you know, a bother. Right. And then I also kind of, you know, I was a kid and I would be a kid and I was a little girl and little girls are screechy. We make screechy noises when we laugh and scream and stuff. And like that always annoyed him. Mm. So I felt like I annoyed him and that he wasn't that interested in me, in spending time with me, I think. Yeah. So yeah, and my parents would fight a lot. I mean, they had a loving relationship and they stayed together until they, you know, till they passed away. I mean, they stayed wow. together for a long time. But, you know, like I said, my dad's really impatient and restless and unregulated emotions, you know, very angry easily. Yeah. Oh, and very defensive. He was hugely defensive, which made him unsafe, right? So like you were always having to worry about like hurting his feelings or mm-hmm. setting him off. I mean, he was very, very rejection sensitive and criticism sensitive. And my mom mm-hmm. would just like tiptoe around him like, oh, it's mm-hmm. gonna hurt your dad's feelings. You know, yeah. So he would always be, you know, impatient and in a hurry. And she's just like unorganized and daydreamy and mm-hmm. running late and flustered and overwhelmed all the time. And so he'd be yelling at her, we got to get out the door. And she'd be, you know, flustered and they'd like get into these crazy fights. And I even used to say as a little kid, I'd be like, you guys fight about stupid stuff. Yeah. They were always like, fighting about little things.
Yeah. You know,
because they were really emotionally immature, even though, despite the fact that they had been to therapy and, mm-hmm. and were progressive and, mm-hmm. you know, and all of those things. So
that just goes to support your assumption that, like, they worked in therapy, but they weren't truly healing. There was some sort of like barrier for them to really do the healing work. Maybe there was self-awareness, a little bit of awareness. Maybe there's awareness about, you know, their hurts and their traumas, but not the actual excruciating work of like healing. And I do think that those are two different things. You can go to therapy and you can get some awareness, and then you can really do the work of healing.
Yeah. Yeah. And my mom would try and, you know, talk about things, you know, but it always felt very like contrived in a way, mm-hmm. like let's sit down and talk about our feelings and, you know, mm-hmm. and by the time I was a teenager, I don't know, I was just angry with them. Yeah. I really felt like, I think now I realize that I felt like they just, you know, didn't give me what I needed. Mm-hmm. You know? They didn't, I would like act out, you know, yeah. I'm like crying out for help. Yeah. And, you know, the response is, you know, instead of saying, oh my God, our daughter is like 14 years old and getting drunk at parties and mm-hmm. she's having sex with unprotected sex and she's yeah. doing all these things and getting into car accidents. She's doing all these things mm-hmm. that are clearly like, someone please pay attention to me, yeah. you know, and instead of really getting me help. I mean, there was a little bit, you know, I remember I went to therapy for a very short time with my dad, but it was a very short time. Their response was to let's deal with what she's doing, make sure she doesn't do it anymore.
Right.
So that we don't have to feel this way, because it was making my mom anxious and she was worried and she didn't want to feel worried. Mm-hmm. So let's stop the behavior. But not really get to, you know, what's going on with, yeah. you know, what's causing it. And my dad even once was like, I acted out and his response was, how could you do this to me?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a really self-centered
yeah.
approach, right? It's like your acting out is about me. How could right. you do this to me? And you're like, I'm asking for help. What do you think is the effect of growing up and not getting what you need? You keep coming back to this phrase, and I don't know if it's intentional or not, but mm-hmm. you're kind of talking very matter-of-factly about everything. Mm-hmm. And then just saying the phrase, I just didn't get what I needed, which I think is so poignant. Like, they weren't terrible people. Like, they had trauma. They were acting out some of their traumas. It's fine, but I didn't get what I needed. What's the effect on a person when they don't get what they need from a family system?
I think that I just never developed a good self-image. I mean, I didn't, I don't think I felt like I deserved to, you know, to get what I needed. I was a big people pleaser. Mm-hmm. I would not take emotional risks because I was so afraid of rejection. You know, I was really hard on myself. I didn't like mm-hmm. myself. I didn't like myself very much. You know, I kind of, and this was well into adulthood. I think I finally, in my late 20s, early 30s, started to get better. And I, you know, like I said, I went to therapy and everything and worked through some of this. But for a long time, you know, I just didn't think I had very much to offer. And I didn't feel like I could ask for things. You know, like people would say, where do you want to eat? And I would always say, I don't care. You know, like I never wanted, or I never learned to express what I wanted, because it was like, you know, who's listening? And plus, I was always so afraid that if I did, that I would lose people. You know,
yes.
If I say I don't really want to go to that movie, I'd rather go to the museum. You know, like my friend would just be like, oh, fine, I'm not going to be friends with you anymore. Just for something so small as that. You know, yeah. I was pretty much a mess. Yeah. I mean, I can't blame it all on, you know, on my parents. And I don't. And I did yeah. a lot of work to like forgive them and, mm-hmm. and all of that. Mm-hmm. But it does, you know, it does have an impact. I mean, they didn't get what they needed either.
Exactly.
Right.
So, like, and that's what we're talking about, is that generational pattern that we will automatically pass down to our own kids, or if we don't have kids, then to our partners or our friends or what, any human that we're interacting with, we're going to pass that pattern on if we don't take time to interrupt it.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, I mean, it depends on your situation and, you know, how much damage and what kind of damage your family has done to you. In my case, you know, I knew that my parents were good people and that damage that they did was unintentional. And it was important for me to understand them as people and see them as children.
Yeah.
And forgive them because they did the best they could, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that was part of the process. And I let go of a lot of anger. And I think that's, I mean, for me, that was important.
Yeah.
You have reasons to stay angry, stay angry. But they were open to hearing me as an adult, you know, like I told them, I feel like, you know, I needed some things from you that I didn't get, you know, and they were open to that. I mean, they were, they were not resistant like some families are.
That's, I mean, that's so beautiful. An ADHD diagnosis is valid and real. And I fully accept my own ADHD diagnosis, even though my childhood was riddled with trauma. And I fully validate your ADHD diagnosis, even though your childhood was riddled with trauma. But do you ever wonder, since the symptoms of complex PTSD, complex trauma, what happens in our brain when we've experienced chronic trauma, since the symptoms of that is so closely related to the symptoms of ADHD, do you ever wonder, is it ADHD or is it complex PTSD? Is that a question that you ask yourself, or do you just kind of move on with your life and you're just healing and so it doesn't really matter either way?
I hadn't really, before, you know, talking to you about this, I hadn't really thought about PTSD. I have thought a lot about, you know, how much of my being late was just like a learned bad habit, you know, because my mother was always late, you know, and how much of it, you know, was learned, or how much of it was
totally
chemical. I think that, I mean, just with ADHD or anything else brain related, because our brains are so complex and everything's all tangled up.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's ever possible to untangle it all. You know, I think there's probably a combination in most cases going on, whether it's ADHD or whether it's, you know, depression or whether it's schizophrenia. And there's some combination. I think we can be genetically or biologically predispositioned, and that things that happen in our lives, you know, whether it's trauma, or it could even be like a change in hormones or something. I mean, look at postpartum, like there are women who don't have any significant episodes of depression or mania before they have a kid. And then suddenly they're like having psychotic episodes. I mean, it does happen, you know, things. And I think that environmental influences in our life can definitely contribute and exacerbate, you know, and I mean, the way that you grow up is certainly going to have an impact on, you know, on how bad your symptoms are or how you're able to deal with them and all of that. So,
That's a beautiful answer. I really appreciate that, because what you did was you added in a lot of nuance. And I think that's exactly what we need as we wrestle with these questions. Like, is it nature or is it nurture? It's like, it's probably both. And that's okay. You know, it's probably both. And that is okay. And Do we know if it's more nature or if it's more nurture? It's probably different for everybody. The cocktail of like our life, if that makes sense, like our childhood, our even like if there was poverty, if there was financial instability, if there was limited food access, like all of that is going to influence if you had a safe place to go or if you didn't have a safe place to go. It's all going to impact how you deal with it, just like you said, how you figure out how to navigate it. Some people with ADHD had parents who taught them coping skills. Other people did not. Like, so it's all just kind of tangled. And I think it's important to have these conversations because we're all kind of processing how much of this is just me, how much of this is family influence, how much of this is like just the way that my brain is wired. Those are important questions to just reflect on and process. But the answer that I always come back to is like, if you have ADHD symptoms and a diagnosis, get treated for it. Take it seriously, because it doesn't really matter if it's nature versus nurture. If you're symptomatic, at least deal with the symptoms.
Yeah.
Right. And if you have capacity to go deeper, sure, go deeper. But like, let's just do a baseline, a triage, like we call it in Focus. Let's just triage and make sure like the symptoms are taken care of.
Right. And because it does make a huge difference. I mean, people who get help at an early age, you can thrive.
Yeah.
You can thrive, you know, with extra help, but you have to know what's going on. You have to have a diagnosis for what's going on, and then tools, whatever the tools are, whatever tools work for you to address it, you know, because I mean, I think we really need to distinguish between undiagnosed and diagnosed and treated ADHD, which
very big difference
is a really crappy name. And I wish they would change it because it's just like not very representative.
No,
you know, what we know today about ADHD, the name does not really cut it anymore.
Agreed.
You know, so that's another
topic. Last question. Can someone who is late diagnosed, can they thrive? Can someone diagnosed in their 50s learn to thrive? Give us some encouragement on that before we sign off.
Totally. It's harder because you got a lot more years to unravel, you know, you got a lot more things to unlearn. They're messages. You got to unlearn all those messages. And the longer you hear those messages, like even from yourself, you know, like, I'm such a loser. That voice, I'm such a loser. Like just year after year. I mean, that's a lot. You got to unravel and unlearn. And, you know, it takes a little bit of time and it takes work, but it's totally possible. Like,
totally possible.
How could it not be possible? But that's just giving up, right?
Love. It's never too late.
I spent so much time giving up. Giving up used to be my go-to, you know. When things get hard, give up. When I'm not having a good experience one place, move to another place. Just keep moving. Try and, you know, every week would be like, this week's going to be different than the last week. Every single Monday, I'm going to do it different this week than last week. And, you know, you can't get anywhere that way. You can't give up and you can't just like pretend, you know. So once you are not pretending anymore and you know what's going on, then you do what you need to do. And I'm not going to give up anymore because done with that.
Oh, what a beautiful way to end this conversation. I'm not going to give up anymore because I'm just done with that. I love it. Thank you. I so appreciate you being here. I know it's a big emotional investment to have this conversation, and I just want to honor you and say thank you so much. So grateful. Oh,
you're very welcome. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Hey, ADHDer, I see you. I know exactly what it's like to feel lost, confused, frustrated, and like no one out there really understands the way that your brain works. That's why I created Focus. Focused is my monthly coaching program where I lead you through a step-by-step process of understanding yourself, feeling better, and creating the life that you know you're meant for. You'll study, be coached, grow, and make amazing changes alongside of other educated professional adults with ADHD from all over the world. Visit ihaveadhd.com/focused to learn more.